So hello and welcome to the very first edition of The Rabbi and the Shrink. I'm Abigail Morris, and with me in the studio today is Rabbi Miriam Berger and psychiatrist Dr. Mark Borelowitz. In this first episode, we'll be talking about marking time, which is what Wellspring is all about. But what is Wellspring? And does it exist? And why, Miriam, would you leave a job you love to create an organisation that doesn't exist?
Hello. It's wonderful to be here, and mostly because I love talking about Wellspring, which is my absolute passion project. Being a congregational rabbi for 18 years was extraordinary. Walking people's life's journey, being part of all of those different milestones with them was a complete privilege. But what it did for me was also unpack the failings of modern Judaism. The Judaism of old was established, I think, by not just ancient rabbis, but they themselves were psychologists. If you look at the rituals that we now take for granted, understanding why they exist allows us to understand the significance that they once played in our lives, which is really different from today. Like, we might understand what it means to a prepubescent teen being accompanied into teenage life in a way that A, they feel proud of their accomplishments, and B, they feel loved and celebrated. But what about something that, you know, like the Sheva Brachot? So for those that don't know from Sheva Brachot, because again, they've dropped out of society for a lot of us, each night for the first week after a couple get married, they are joined by guests in order to eat and say grace after meals, including these seven marital blessings. Is it so they can fulfill the obligation of saying these blessings each night? Or is it just because dinner with the man you've just married, who you hardly know, could be really an awkward situation? And, you know, Judaism does bereavement, I think, extraordinarily well, acknowledging that it's different in the first week, than the first month, than the first year. But actually, modern life has thrown all sorts of other milestones with us. And I think our Judaism has become like the lawyers rather than the psychologists. So over the generations, we've become obsessed with doing our Judaism right and getting to the letter of the law so that we all do it in exactly the same way. But what we've forgotten about is being the psychologists and being able to respond to life in a way that holds and supports people. So what I really hope that Wellspring becomes is a place that acknowledges our Judaism as putting the psychologists first and being able to say, let's support you through these milestone moments, creating ritual with you so that we can support you like the rabbis of old.
So, Miriam's neatly said that that Judaism hasn't become the psychologist. As the psychologist, psychiatrist, Mark, how would you see marking time and the need for that in a psychological setting?
So I'm delighted to be part of this too, because I think every mental health professional knows that getting better, and especially staying better, doesn't end in the professional person's office. It ends, it's sustained by home and community. And I'm hoping that we're going to use home and community as the psychologists rather than the professional people for these purposes. And Miriam, you talked about the rabbis being the original psychologists. I think of Aristotle as being the original cognitive psychologist. He said, we don't wake up programmed to do good every day. We have to decide we want to, and then we have to practice really hard. We have to have decision and intent and then practice. And so he began talking about ritual a long time ago. And we all know you can't go to... If you're so exhausted that you don't need any bedtime ritual, then you're too exhausted. We all need a bedtime ritual. We need ritual to help us look forward to going out and then decompressing after going out. Ritual's baked into our lives. But rituals become vulnerable because of the pace of life and because stuff that used to be embedded in ritual is getting undermined. Like, instead of going to a restaurant, you get a takeout and so on. And so everything has become a bit takeout-y. And I think we have to be careful to refine those rituals once again and cherish them.
So, Miriam, in terms of just telling us a bit more, is there any bit more you could tell about Wellspring and it discovering ritual before we...
Yeah, so I think it's easy to see religions in general, you know, we have that phrase, hatch, match and dispatch, that actually it defines what the milestones are by the kind of most basic forms of birth, marriage and death. But actually, if you talk to anybody about what their most fundamental moments are in their life, the point that they came to a crossroads and had to make decisions, or the things that changed them fundamentally, who they are, I'd be surprised if it was only those three kind of big events in life that actually were the things that people came down to as being the most defining moments in their life. And so, you know, the rabbis of old could not have imagined what it feels like to have spent an entire year visiting the chemo ward and then being told that actually you're in remission, or what it means to know that your partner has had a long-term diagnosis, which means that you have to not reframe the entire outlook for what your future looks like too, and perhaps the retirement that you've been working so hard to enjoy together. Now, all of that's being rewritten for you both, not just for the person who's had the diagnosis, or what it means to take a loved one to a residential care home and to know what it is that's changing in their life and your life. So I think there's something about these moments that we have to accept are going to change us and going to change who we are. And even if they're things we've decided, we might be the person who's walked out on a marriage and said, I need to end this. That doesn't mean we can walk into a new chapter and necessarily feel fulfilled or without the burdens of the choice and the decision that you have made. How much more so if that choice has been made by your partner rather than you? You know, for me, this the moment that I think of when if someone says to me, what's the defining moment of who you are and your family, for me was mine and my husband's infertility journey. We'd had our first child in a very kind of what seems now very straightforward manner. And therefore, it took us by surprise when we had many, many failed attempts to get pregnant for a second time, an IVF and miscarriages, and had to get to the point where actually we realized we were not going to have a second child. And there was a lot of reframing what that looks like, that we didn't want to be constantly the people that were living through the bereavements of what we didn't have, or being jealous of friends that seemed to have exactly what we wanted. How could we reframe our outlook on life that said, these are the benefits to it just being the three of us? How lucky are we? We didn't know what a miracle child our child was until we knew, realized we couldn't have a second. How much more do we not take him and his very existence for granted? And actually, you know, it's really easy to say to someone, oh, stop trying and another child will come along. Just putting the warning out there to anybody. It's the most annoying thing you can say to somebody who's struggling with fertility. But actually, how do you say to a married couple, stop trying and actually really mean it and not feel that there's kind of some kind of hope? And so for us, there was a need to do two things. To start using contraception so that we knew we were not going to have a second child and that there was no longer that sense of hope. And I used a mikveh. And I'm not someone that before that used a mikveh on a regular basis or for nidah, for the kind of traditional uses of mikveh. But actually, I needed to say I need to stop punishing my body for being the thing that hasn't succeeded, and accept my body for what it is, and to be grateful for all that it is doing, that it's, you know, being able to nourish me, support my family, and to be able to allow me to be out in the world and feeling fulfilled and successful. So again, marking that moment allowed me to have a real change of heart and real different headspace.
That's really beautiful. I want to come back to Ritva, but before we do, Mark, I'd like to ask you, what's brought you to Wellspring?
Three things. Firstly, rather like Miriam's experience, although my own experience obviously has been different, I see for myself and for the young people who come to my office how one can be preoccupied with an issue, and so preoccupied that it undermines one's relationship, undermines one's quality of life, and one becomes unable to see what else one has in life. And it is so important to notice that and get help with that. And secondly, when I was training, I read about an American psychiatrist called Mona Weiss, who argued against our obsession with classification of illness and said, don't waste your time trying to work out whether a patient's got depression type A, B, C, D, or E. Have a think about what the depression is stopping them doing that they would like to do and they need to do, and help them with that. And that's a great idea, but the NHS is very short of money. NICE, this very important organization which says what treatments we should offer, says 8 sessions of CBT for this and antidepressants for that. And it's not about getting your life back on track. It's not about rebuelding your life. And so I'm seeing Wellspring as a really, really wonderful opportunity to use the community to help people do what the official services just don't do. They would love to, but they don't and they can't. And then thirdly, psychiatry and psychology deliberately abandoned spirituality many years ago because they wanted to come across as more scientific. And they saw spirituality as undermining professionalism. Times moved on, and, you know, Miriam, you talked about Judaism becoming the lawyer. We're actually not allowed to talk to our patients about religion. You can fall foul of a discrimination claim or complaint. So we have to be very, very careful about that. And the language that we end up using is about mindfulness and meaning. And there's nothing wrong with that. But again, I'm looking to learn from Wellspring about how I can get to another level for myself and in my work so we can underpin the desire for meaning in a slightly stronger way.
I love that that quote that you used about not what are you treating, but what do you want the treatment to do?
Yeah.
For me, that's exactly what I hope I've been using ritual for over my years in the Rabbinate. That actually people have come to me with all sorts of kind of moments in their life and all sorts of kind of complex emotions that go with that. And being able to talk through, where do you need to go? Like, what do you need to feel now? You know, there's a kind of, I tend to find myself using that kind of catch-all phrase of what does it mean to find acceptance? But perhaps that's not always the appropriate kind of moment. But for instance, you know, a couple that came to see me, the husband had had an affair, they'd been married for a long time, they had kids. They both really wanted the marriage to work and to continue. But they also were struggling with trust and kind of letting go of what had happened, and all of the apologies in the world kind of weren't helping. And they'd come to me thinking what they wanted was just, can we redo our marriage vows? And actually what we realized when talking was that they needed to be able to let go of something before they recommitted to each other. And therefore, they used actually the mikveh together as a couple to acknowledge what it was they were letting go of. And I think for the wife also to kind of feel that sense of, how can I almost cleanse my husband's body and renew it for me again before they then kind of, in a Jewish sense, recommitted to one another and stood under a chuppah privately together again. So I think there's, for me, that real essence of understanding what you need from a ritual in order to make it meaningful.
So is there something about the physicality of the ritual that's important?
So that's why I love mikveh, because for me, you can't unconsciously get in a mikveh or in water in general. And what mikveh does is not just prioritize the moment in the water, but prior to that as well, it gives you all these steps of preparing your body. Now, you know, I'm not about it needing to be, I need to make sure that, you know, your nail varnish has been taken off and you've plucked any hairs off of your body, but rather about what does it mean to prepare each part of you, what you can see, what you can hear, what you're thinking. And actually, even that thing of a cotton bud and clearing out your ear, there's something about what do I want to stop hearing of the voices in my head after this ritual that are really gives you that moment to think about in terms of that preparation? What are the thoughts I'm trying to get rid of and the new thoughts I'm trying to replace in this very conscious moment of immersing in water?
So just talking about immersion in water, and the immersion in water is known, particularly cold water, is known to be a very powerful experience because you have to be in the moment. Do you see mikvahs having to be cold water?
So I don't. I think it can be two things. One of my real kind of fantasies at Wellspring is that we do have a kind of cold water outdoor opportunity, because I think there's, for a lot of people, that water and nature combination is really significant for them. But for me, there's something warm and womb-like of the waters of the mikveh, that actually there's something cosseting and pleasant and cozy about the mikveh waters, which is different from the sort of outdoor swimming vibe. I recently returned from holiday where we were in hot springs, and watching the kind of the community of people who clearly meet at the hot springs on a regular basis, this is part of their well-being practices, was for me much more akin to mikveh than perhaps the outdoor swimming. Because as you stepped into the hot water, there was a real sense of your body relaxing, rather than what your body does when you go into cold water, which is take that breath out of you, which I think both have a role in this moment. Personally, I'm the warm water person.
Mark, what's your take on immersion and water immersion?
So physiology wasn't my best subject at medical school, I'm afraid. But water is powerful. It's literally powerful physically. You can go for a walk in shorts at 7 degrees centigrade, and if you're reasonably healthy, you won't suffer harm. Immerse yourself in water 7 degrees centigrade, you're going to change incredibly quickly, and you're going to really, really cool down. It touches you in a way that the air doesn't. And so whether it's warm or cold, just getting in there makes a big difference. It's touching the whole surface area of the body in a way that very few other experiences do. And even massage doesn't touch you all at once, just touches parts of the body. Immersion gets the entire surface area of the body, and it's immediately physiologically transformative. So, in the office, we talk about if you're having a panic attack, change your physiology, control your breathing, or get up and move around, anything that changes your current state. And Miriam, you're talking about trying to do something not as an emergency, not desperate, but planned to immerse and notice. And I'm totally with that.
What about the fact, do you think that immersion has to be witnessed, or that the ritual has to be witnessed, or do you think it's best solitary?
So I think witnessing is a huge part of ritual in general, and a huge part in what it means to transition from one kind of state of being to another. It's why we invite people along to our weddings, right? You can tell your partner you love them as often as you like. Why do we need to have goodness knows how many people sat in a room when we make that commitment to each other? I think there's something significant about saying, this is a moment for me where I want to see myself and be seen as somebody different. And therefore, I think, so much of ritual happens within community. There's a reason for that. For me, that's different to needing, your traditional mikveh lady that people might have heard of, that really their function is to make sure you've done it properly, right? That you've fully immersed, that every bit of you has gone under the water. For me, it's not that kind of witnessing. And therefore, I'd much prefer someone to use the mikveh alone because perhaps they don't feel comfortable being physically witnessed in that state. But, in my mind, what would be a beautiful thing for Wellspring when we're able to build is to have a wall between the mikveh and a kind of waiting room where friends and family can be, where perhaps they can't see into the mikveh, but perhaps they can hear into the mikveh, so that there is an ability to be able to speak, to hear, to either hear the splash of the water and to for that person to know, you see, I've done it. I've made this commitment to myself, and you were here when I made that commitment. But also, this could be a joyous event or a sad event. And what does it mean to have the voices of your loved ones maybe singing with you or for you, or to be reciting, you know, poetry or blessings, to feel that sense of I'm not alone in this journey, whether I'm physically in the water alone or not.
And Mark, do you see that as a tension in your practice, that you'd like to create rituals maybe at the end of a treating someone, but actually, by its very nature, your practice is very private?
Our practice is private, but I think we wouldn't have cafes and restaurants and event planners if we didn't have a desire to celebrate in public, and sometimes sort of in private in public, but I mean a small group, but in a cafe rather than at home. And so I've been thinking about the young woman who was recovering from her anorexia, and she had a period, and she told me, and I told my friends in school, and they gave me a hug, and that felt good. So she wanted to make an announcement to them for a whole range of reasons, which I'll let people to think about for themselves. But I think that sort of public statement that something's happened to me and I'd like you to pay attention, not too much attention. They all then went off into the maths lesson. I think we all seem to need that. And Miriam, I like the idea of being accompanied to the building, going to the mikveh on your own, and then somebody there for you afterwards. And going back to Myrna Weiss, for our patients with eating disorders who are getting better and were going to university, we asked them to make a list. What do you need to be able to do in order for university to be sustainable? Eating in a cafeteria. Okay, we've got a cafeteria in the hospital. One of our team will help you practice cafeteria eating. And firstly, there was a skill that they needed to be able to learn. But secondly, it meant I'm moving on. But the nurse was there to be with them, to assist the moving on and to witness it. And they appreciated that. Being sent off to do it on their own wouldn't have worked.
And we're here in January. Yeah. And we're here in the bit of January where people's resolutions start to disappear. But we're talking about new beginnings. Do you think they're really possible? I mean, people have that fantasy of, yeah, the new me. Come next week, I'll stop eating chocolate forever or whatever it is.
I do have a real sense of being able, I don't think it's a new me in terms of kind of a commitment to, you know, do something like that, you know, to the eating chocolate is a good example, because who are you really doing it for? Are you really doing it for how you feel about yourself and for your own health? Or are you doing it about how other people see you? And is that enough of a kind of impetus to really invoke change? But I do think that new beginnings are really important. And I do think there's a sense of, when they're for the right reasons, when you're helped to achieve those moments, I think they can exist and be powerful. I think they're really difficult to do when it's just a hunch and it's just a change of date and it's just this is an arbitrary moment as to why I'm doing this. You know, for me, the biblical motif of the children of Israel leaving Egypt and crossing the sea is, for me, the thing I come back to, that, you know, it took the 10 plagues to get them to the water's edge, right? It took so many moments to see around them the need for change. It then took real faith on the edge of the water to actually take those steps in. You know, you can get there, but also it needs that extra leap the other side. And what happens as soon as they've crossed, they've had their moment of ritual, they're singing, they're waving their tambourines. You know, you think this is the new beginning, but actually within the same parasha, they're moaning and they're wondering whether that change was really important to them and whether really they'd have been better off the other side of the sea. And it takes years to actually invoke that change. And so for me, there's something about the ritual being the beginning of the journey, however difficult it is to get to that moment, and know that it takes real discipline to continue after the ritual and to remind ourselves why we started the journey towards the new me.
So unsurprisingly, as a rabbi, you've given that quite a Jewish framing. Which is great. But you also give Wellspring a Jewish framing. How important is that to you, and in what way is it particular and Jewish?
For me, it's Judaism at its essence, because it's Jewish ritual that we're using in mikveh, and I don't take that for granted. But do I think it's a universal message for everybody? Absolutely. Mikveh for me is powerful because it comes with a sense of connecting me with the past, of acknowledging that this is something that my ancestors have used in this moment. You know, women for generations have been using mikveh after they've had a period. For me, that's not because it was a coercive control to get them back into bed with their husbands, but rather because every period, in a time where you'd have been striving to have as many children as possible, every period was another month where you weren't pregnant, or a potential that was lost. And therefore, it gave those women just a moment out of their real lives to grieve, to be, and to gain the strength to start again. And so for me, I'm constantly being connected through mikveh back to the strength and the resolve of the women in every generation that's gone before me. So for me, it's got real particular Jewish kind of connotations, but does the importance of marking moments and, drawing lines and closing chapters, really, it's for everybody.
Miriam, it sounds like mikveh is just for Jewish women. Is that right?
Not at all, and it never has been. I mean, in terms of mikveh itself, has always been something that men were obligated to immerse at different times as well. We don't tend to talk much about after nocturnal emissions, but also before Shabbat or festivals is often a time where a man will kind of ready themselves by using the mikveh for those times. But just like in every culture, there are those moments of immersion, whether it's, in the Ganges or at baptism, whether it's the cleaning that's done, the washing of one's body by Muslims before they pray. There's something really significant about water in so many religions for men and for women, that I think we need to understand that there's a reason why so many religions have got this as a core part of their practice, and we shouldn't let it go.
Can I ask you two questions about that, Miriam?
Okay.
I don't know a single man of my age who's been to a mikveh, and I wonder why that is. And then my second question is, when you talk about the Ganges or baptism, these are not private. These are quite public. These are community activities. How, when I think about mikveh and I think about menstruation, nocturnal admission, I can understand why it's private, but it's become like exclusively private. And how come we don't have some kind of communal immersion in Judaism?
It's interesting, and I think it's about less about how it came about and more about how it evolved. And I think that the evolution of mikveh is really where it's become, in many circles, a really problematic ritual. And I know that some people will tell me that we'll never clean up the ritual of mikveh because it's been so tainted by abusive, coercive behavior. But actually, I think maybe it's easier for somebody who comes from a progressive background and therefore actually because of that evolution, mikveh had very much been sidelined by the progressive Jewish world because of its seen as not being egalitarian and be seen as antiquated. And I realize how much we've lost from that, that we actually have to get back to its kind of authenticity rather than allow it to be defined by its evolution. And that goes for a lot of rituals within Judaism, I would hasten to say. And I think the communal piece is all about that coercive nature of what does it mean to see these things as private. Actually, a period, especially if it's because of, you know, a miscarriage or of infertility, should not be private. We should be able to have these conversations, and we should be able to have them publicly. Going to mikveh should not be something that people see as kind of this thing they need to creep off and do alone.
So, Mark, I'd like to take you back to eating disorders and the fact that they don't have clear endings.
Eating disorders don't. The other areas in which I work and have worked, ADHD, autism, don't. And depression, which lurks with all those conditions, doesn't. So I think people are understandably wary about celebrating a neat ending. But people are so keen to mark the waypoints. And a young woman who was just so unwell, one day I walked into the waiting room and I saw that she had dyed her hair orange. Now, why does this matter so much to me? One of the lovely things about being a doctor working with adolescents is when they say, I need to explain something that I think you don't understand. I think, excellent, great that you can talk to me like that. Now I'm about to learn something. And early on when I was starting out, a young woman said, no, it's not about being thin. It's about being invisible. I want to be invisible. So when someone dyes her hair orange, she no longer wants to be invisible. She's telling everybody, here I am. And I just love that. And young people sometimes write us cards when they finish. Now, they're not finishing their journey. They're just finishing with us, and it's a punctuation point. And one of my favorites is, my thanks to you and your team for seeing me as more than just my eating disorder. Now, our work is sometimes hard. It's great to get a compliment, and I'll take a compliment at face value. But you can probably see where I'm going to. She wrote down for herself that she was more than just her eating disorder. And that was so special that she noticed that now. She was no longer defined by her eating disorder. It lurked, but there was much more to her. And I think that's the way that people mark the different stages in their health journey. And I think mental health is not like a 5-year cancer all clear. And is that ever really an all clear or not? We're not exactly sure, but it is worth celebrating. Mental health is more nuanced than that, and there's always a risk of slipping back. So it's, I think people understandably want to mark and want to be seen mark. Well, people write cards because it's part of this thing of wanting to be seen and observed. They share it with us and they value that. And, the journey begins with, I don't think there's a new beginning, there's a journey. It begins with, I need to go and see the doctor to get a referral, and then I need to get the appointment, then I need to attend the appointment. If society makes it hard to get the referral, you have to wait 2 years, we make it so much harder for people. But it's always a journey with waypoints. And each stage, I think we probably underestimate how challenging it is to say, I go off and need help. Or in the adolescent mental health professional's office, where the young person's giving you a look, they want to talk to us on their own now without their parents. And what a brave and trusting step that is. It means something. And every one of these steps means something. And we have to have enough time and sensitivity ourselves to notice that, obviously. Otherwise, they don't get noticed and then the meaning is lost.
Lovely. Thank you. So, particularly since the pandemic, the last few years, there's been a big resurgence in communal wild swimming and people going swimming together in a secular way. Do you think that's the secular world moving in on immersion? And do you think that's what happens more about the secular world claiming rituals and marking time in a way that the religious world has done before?
My husband and son will definitely laugh at this bit, because I'm a bit obsessed with the frustration of the more the world becomes secular, the more we find these crazy rituals, right? People go nuts for Halloween, for, the kind of what are they called? The Santa things, the elf on the shelf, gender reveal. We're making up rituals and family ways of celebrating and ways of marking time in society because people are lacking religion in their lives. And what's sad to me is not that they're creating ritual, because I think ritual's amazing, but they're creating ritual that doesn't have any meaning behind it. And yes, it might be fun, and yes, it might create nice family moments, but actually I think it's a sad kind of indictment on society when we have to create ritual with no meaning, when there are so many rituals available to us with not just a history attached, but with values and deep-rooted values connecting you to them.
Thank you. Yeah. So to wrap us up, Miriam, what would you say to people creating rituals to mark time in their own lives?
I think there's a moment where I see in wider society people do it at their absolute worst. And maybe this is a bit of a challenge to you, Mark, because I'm sure you've done it very thoughtfully. But the thing I think we do worst in this world is retirement. That people are excited, look forward to, I'm going to say particularly this one is out there for men. Often their whole identity has been so wrapped up in their job that when they fantasize about retirement and then they fill it with all sorts of things, and often what they fill it with is unpaid work and never actually think about, well, what do I want this new chapter in my life to look like? And I don't think it's easy, and I don't think it's just about suddenly filling one's time. I think it's about really thinking about how do I mark the ending well, and how what do I want from this new chapter?
That resonates with me perfectly, Miriam. And I was kind of not listening to a podcast properly and about retirement until someone said, people spend so much time thinking about what they want to do, they should take a step back and think how they want to be. It's very illuminating in relation to retirement, but I learned rather more about well-being during COVID than I think I'd learned professionally in all the rest of my professional life. And when I was giving talks to younger people, I would encourage them to notice today, while they're still young, what are their values, what do they hold dear? Now they're going to enter the world of adulthood and maybe parenthood and all kinds of things. And notice where they're getting pulled away from what matters to them, and how, you know, does it matter so much that they have to change tack, or do they have to find another way of living with it? And I think that's, I could only say that because I think the workplace has opened up to that, and young people want more meaning in their work, and I think society has had to respond. So COVID gave me a bit of hope for the future, actually, because of the recalibration that made most people with any degree of privilege, made us undertake in relation to where we wanted to go with our lives and how we wanted to be. And that's the hidden blessing of COVID, maybe.
So I think that's our kind of challenge for people who have been listening to this podcast. How about people go away this week and ask themselves the question, not are you doing what you want to do, but rather are you being who you want to be?
Yes.
Thank you very much.